This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. In the late 1970s, seven white women were raped and murdered in Columbus, Georgia. They ranged in age from 59 to 89. Many were strangled with their stockings. In 1986, Carlton Gary, an African American, was convicted and sentenced to death for three of those murders. Today, he sits on death row in Georgia. Carlton Gary's lawyers have appealed, arguing the trial was fundamentally flawed. They say the prosecution had information that could have led to a verdict of not guilty, but they withheld that information from the jury. Meanwhile, it has been alleged that Carlton Gary is responsible for the 1975 rape and strangulation of a woman in New York. Authorities in Syracuse have said they matched Gary's DNA to that left at the scene of the crime, but have no plans to prosecute him as he is waiting execution in Georgia. On the program today, we'll talk about Carlton Gary's arrest and trial, as well as the issue of race and the history of racism in the criminal justice system. Our guest is journalist David Rose. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and the author of The Big Eddie Club, The Stocking Stranglings, and Southern Justice. Rose has followed the case now for a decade. In addition to this being a story about Carlton Gary, Rose sees it as about being about an American history and a history of a city that includes racism, lynching, and unsolved murders. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. David Rose has worked for The Guardian, The Observer, and the BBC. He is the author of five previous books, including Guantanamo. That book and his latest, The Big Eddie Club, are published by The New Press. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. David Rose, good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. You report that the prosecution had information that could have led to a verdict of not guilty, but they concealed that information. What did they conceal?
Well, the truth is, they concealed an awful lot. When they presented the case at Carlton Gary's trial in 1986, it looked pretty much overwhelming. They said they had a confession. They said they had fingerprints that matched his that were found at four of the seven crime scenes. They said that a witness who had survived the attack by this serial killer, the stocking strangler, had been able to identify him, and that she had never previously identified anybody else, but she was quite sure that Carlton Gary was the man who had attacked and almost killed her 9 years before his trial. In fact, all those key pillars of what became their case were deeply suspect. My investigations over, as you say, about a decade, showed that they were all deeply flawed, that they're all deeply open to question. But on top of that, they hid an enormous body of material that was completely exculpatory. Now, some of that evidence was quite dramatic. It included, for example, the cast of the killer's teeth that was made by a local dentist from a bite wound on the final victim. They hid that item for more than 20 years, and when it was finally tested, it did not match his teeth. The expert, who had in fact been shown it by the cops almost 20 years before and had told them then that it didn't match Carlton Gary's teeth, testified in a federal court in Columbus, Georgia, almost a year ago, in February of last year, that it didn't match Carlton Gary's teeth. He was sure about this to a standard of beyond reasonable doubt. That's just one of many items that the state hid from the trial. And you know, if the jury had had the full picture, I think there's a very strong possibility that they would have reached a different decision.
Mm. How did the state appeals court and now the federal appeals court view these revelations?
Well, of course, it's been a very slow, long unraveling process. This trial was almost 22 years ago now. The crimes go back to the fall of 1977, the spring of 1978. The trail is very cold. bit by bit, new pieces of information have dribbled out. I think one of the important things to say at the outset is that right at the beginning, this case was skewed. The judge who conducted the pretrial stages of the case made a series of legal decisions, rulings, judgments that had the effect that Carlton Garry and his defense lawyers had absolutely no money at all with which to fight his trial. They had no money to trace witnesses, they had no money to find experts, they had no money to do any of the kind of normal investigative work that attorneys will do before a murder trial. So the scales were loaded in a very uneven fashion from the very beginning. Now, when we move to the appellate stage, of course, the appeals process in death penalty cases is long and complex. And indeed, in this case, it has been longer and more complex than in most. for example, the funds issue that I just referred to became the issue for a series of special hearings at the state court level that took up a number of years before the state Supreme Court decided that it really wasn't a problem. It was quite okay in Georgia for people to be sentenced to death without having had any money with which to defend themselves. So gradually, bit by bit, bits of evidence have come out at the different appeal levels, at the direct review appeal stage in the state courts, then at the state habeas corpus stage, when defendants have an opportunity to challenge the constitutional validity of their trial, to argue that their constitutional rights were not observed, and now finally at the federal appeal stage. So there's been this kind of slow dripping out of new testimony, new evidence that both undermines the case presented at the trial and, in fact, consists of wholly new exculpatory material that was hidden altogether. What's happened is that each court has just rubber-stamped the decision of the ones before. Now, one of the things I think is most invidious here, and it really does go to the heart of what due process means in the United States now, is that the way that the courts have looked at this, if there's been a piece of evidence that's been considered as being suspect at an earlier stage, and then, you know, something else comes up, they will go back to that piece of evidence that was considered as an earlier appeal. And if an earlier court didn't give him a new trial, they'll say, well, that's been upheld, that's fine. I'll give you an example. As I say, the police and the state, the district attorney, a man called Bill Smith, who conducted the trial and is now, in fact, a Superior Court judge in Columbus, they said that they had this confession that after they arrested Carlton Garry, he spoke to the cops for 9 hours. Now, they say they didn't take any notes while they were talking to him. They say they didn't tape him. The story is that one detective of the three who interrogated him went home, wrote notes at his kitchen table at 4:30 in the morning from memory, and produced a close to verbatim account of what Carlton Garry had said over a span of 9 hours. Then, they say, this detective, Michael Sellers, sat down with his two colleagues. 2 months later, he compared their recollections with his, and they then chipped in where they thought there were other bits that he had missed. And they produced a kind of composite-type document, and that was the confession, unsigned, undated, that was presented to the jury. Carlton Garry has always maintained that, in fact, when they questioned him, they did tape him, and moreover, he did not confess to committing any of these crimes or being anywhere near any of the crime scenes. He has always said that the document they presented in court was a fabrication. Now, at the state habeas corpus appeal, the defense was given access to the full district attorney's file, which had been hidden during the trial, and they found a whole mass of material which undermined the state's case. One of the things they found was that, in fact, this typed document had gone through several early drafts, and paragraphs and sentences had literally been cut and pasted and moved around till they had the final version. And they also found that there were marks that clearly referred to tape recorder meter markings in the margins of this document. Interestingly, these marginal notes weren't in sections that were highly incriminating that had him anywhere near the murders, but when he was describing innocuous activity, I believe that they just put these taped sections in because they made the whole thing kind of authentic. It reflected the way he talked. Well, this all came out at the state habeas appeal, and the district attorney himself, Bill Smith, took the stand at this appeal, and he testified that it was true that this document had, in fact, gone through a number of permutations and versions, although nothing had been said about this at the trial. He also said it was true that these markings related to tape recordings, but he claimed that they were not tapes of the actual interrogation, but tapes of a meeting that he had had with the police 2 years after Carlton Gary's arrest, shortly before the trial. And then he said he had destroyed these tapes. I mean, it absolutely made no sense. It's so convoluted, his explanation. I mean, frankly, it's preposterous. But the state court didn't give him a new trial on the basis of that or anything else. So when we then move forward to the federal habeas appeal, mm-hmm. the appeal that is now going through its final stages, the courts have taken the view, okay, you have a bite cast. It appears to undermine his guilt. It shows, according to this expert, who was one of the world's leading authorities on the subject, he did not bite this victim. And it's true that it was hidden by the state for 20 years. However, it doesn't make any difference. And this is what a federal judge said in May of last year when he issued his opinion. The judge said it doesn't matter because there's still other evidence in this case, such as his confession. And the fact that that confession itself is deeply suspect, it's kind of no longer under consideration. So it's a long answer to your question, but the way the appeals process seems to work is that, you know, things are considered piecemeal, one by one. And if something's upheld as okay testimony, well, that's it. You never get another chance to, as it were, throw that into the balance.
Now, as I understand it, the case is before the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. When is a ruling expected?
Well, what happened was that the district court, the federal district court in Columbus, refused him a new trial in May 2007, and the main issue under consideration was the bite cast. There was one other actually quite important issue, which was that footprints had been found at one of the crime scenes. The killer had climbed onto an air conditioning unit, had left footprints which do not match Carlton Gary's feet. They're, in fact, about five sizes smaller than Carlton Gary's feet. And at a very late stage, when I was producing this book, towards the end of 2006, an investigator who'd had a senior position in the case back in the 80s contacted me and produced these prints and the photos he'd taken, and with a scale and everything, showing that the killer's feet were a different size to Carlton Gary. So that was turned down. The case moved to the 11th Circuit, and there was a hearing in September at which a whole bunch of issues were aired. And in fact, one of the judges in the 11th Circuit, one of the three federal appeal court judges there, said that the conduct of this case was, as he put it, absolutely terrible and unethical. And having heard how the prosecution had fought the case, he said that if he were the Attorney General of Georgia, he would have an investigation into the Columbus authorities. But that was, from Carlton Gary's perspective, an encouraging sign, but that court has not yet issued its decision, and it could literally be tomorrow, it could be in 6 months' time. It's a big case, there are many issues to consider, you know, and it's also politically extremely sensitive, especially in Georgia. We just don't know which way it will go, and it could be at any time that what will probably be his final chance of getting a new trial will be decided one way or the other.
Mm. In my introduction, I mentioned this case in New York. What do you think about the alleged link between Gary and the rape and strangulation of a woman in 1975 in New York State? And what has Gary said about that case?
Well, this is a very, very curious thing indeed. The state and the FBI database has had Carlton Gary's DNA on file since DNA testing became available in the early 1990s. I should say in relation to that that in many death penalty cases, of course, especially in cases where there is a sexual assault, bodily fluids are found at the scene and they are preserved. And later on, perhaps many years down the track, people on death row have had their DNA compared to those fluids and they've been found not to match. And as of this moment, it's almost 200 people have been released from death rows up and down the United States because of DNA tests which show that the samples don't match. You can't do this in Carlton Gary's case because according to the state, right at that time that DNA testing started to be used in criminal appeals in the early 1990s, and when the defense wrote to to the state lab asking for the original samples from the stocking strangling crime scenes, apparently they were destroyed as, quote, a biohazard, unquote. However, they did take a sample of Carlton Gary's DNA at that time, and it's been on a database ever since. There was a cold case from Syracuse, New York, a lady called Marion Fisher. Very different sort of case to the stocking stranglings. She was a woman of 40, much younger than the stocking strangling victims, who, as you said in your introduction, the youngest was 59. She wasn't attacked late at night in her own home. She was not indeed a woman who lived alone. She was a married woman, and she had gone to a bar. She had had a very heated argument with her husband. She had accused him of cheating on her, and she'd hit him and walked out of the bar and disappeared. And a couple of days later, her body was found on a golf course somewhere between the bar where she'd had the argument with her husband and her home. What the authorities claimed in Syracuse, New York, in the summer of 2007, was that a towel found near her body contained a DNA sample that matched Carlton Gary's. And so they said that they believed that Carlton Gary had murdered this woman. They went down to Georgia, cops from Syracuse, New York. They interviewed Carlton Gary on death row without a lawyer present. I have a letter from him in which he says he made no admission. He says he hasn't any idea what this case refers to. And what is interesting is that this revelation came out in the media in Georgia 10 days before his appeal hearing in the 11th Circuit. I am not a conspiracy theorist, but it looked to me like a crude attempt to influence the 11th Circuit Appeals Court. They were about to hear a whole mass of material that cast doubt on the police investigation and the conduct of the prosecution of the stocking strangling murders in Columbus. And now suddenly they're being told, via the media, not through any formal communication from the state's lawyers, that Carlton Gary is in fact a cold-blooded killer, that he's not accused of, but it was reported as if he was definitely guilty of this murder in 1975. And then, about a month after the appeal, the district attorney in Syracuse, New York, said, well, it's not in the interest of justice to take this any further. We're not going to charge him with this crime. It looks very mysterious to me. I can't comment on the details because I just don't know enough about it, but it seems to me very questionable what happened. And if they were so sure that he had killed this woman, well, you know, the family of that victim, who was still living, and her husband is still alive, he was quoted in the Syracuse media at the time that these disclosures were made in the summer, you know, that they deserve justice too, and yet they're not going to take it any further. I find it very suspicious.
You say at the time of the stocking stranglings, the authorities in Columbus were convinced that the perpetrator was black. Why?
Well, that's a very interesting question. The murders, and in fact there were two unsuccessful attacks of women who both survived, all but one of these nine attacks took place in a very small, upscale, all-white neighborhood called Winton. A very old neighborhood. It has a number of antebellum homes. It's where the famous novelist Carson McCullers lived and wrote some of her greatest books. Once the first couple of murders had happened, this area was swarming with cops, with state troopers, with soldiers from the nearby military base Fort Benning, with every kind of law enforcement official. And these patrols just carried on for month after month, and the killer was able to strike with apparent impunity despite these patrols. In this very feverish, terrified atmosphere, any African-American walking across this neighborhood, Winton, was likely to be stopped and questioned and would be asked to conduct what were called field interviews, give samples of perhaps hair, maybe even saliva. It was extraordinary. And indeed, there was actually a largely black high school not far from this neighborhood, and it became a very big bone of contention that high school students who lived on one side of this neighborhood and were having to cross it to get to school were being stopped maybe three or four times a week by the cops. It seems, and has always seemed to many people in Columbus, that it would be very difficult for an African-American to be lurking around this neighborhood late at night and killing white women because, you know, you just can't hide that well, and you certainly can't do it so many times. So how did they come to this view that the killer was African-American? Actually, the answer is extraordinary. The coroner of Columbus at that time was a man called Dr. Donald Kilgore. He called himself doctor, but in fact, he had no medical qualification. In fact, he had no qualifications beyond a high school diploma. He was, in fact, an undertaker. He had worked as an embalmist when he was a teenager in his high school vacations. I mean, he's a very eccentric character. He had no scientific background. He certainly had no background in forensic science. But after the first two murders, he told the cops and then the media that pubic hairs that belonged to the killer, recovered from the crime scenes, displayed what he termed were negroid characteristics. A very strange phrase. What did he mean that pubic hairs had negroid characteristics? Well, in fact, extraordinary as it sounds, he meant they were black and curly. Now, in fact, as you probably know, there are white individuals who have black, curly pubic hair. I think there are good grounds to believe that the killer may well have been white. And in fact, one of the two victims who survived, a lady called Ruth Schwobe, identified a white neighbor as the man who had attacked her. She managed to press a panic button. The cops were there within about a minute, which indicates how many patrols were in the area, how close they were to her house. And she was sure that the man who had attacked her was a white man who was known to her. That never seemed to be taken seriously. Somehow or other, the police stuck to this fixed idea that the killer was black.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist David Rose. He is the author of The Big Eddie Club, The Stocking Stranglings, and Southern Justice. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I have a few questions and or comments. I vaguely remember this case, reading about it in the newspapers, and supposedly one of the reasons the police said, oh, they have the right guy, was that the murder stopped afterwards. That's one question. And the other one, there is a book, and this is a somewhat, well, this is far afield, called The Ultimate Evil by Mallory Terry.
Please hold the line.
Can you hear me?
David Hello? Rose, do we still have you?
Yes, sorry.
Okay.
I don't know what happened there. I just got as far as hearing there's a book called The Ultimate Evil.
Okay, we'll go back to our listener and let him finish up. As soon as I'm getting a signal now, just to hold on here. Okay, all right, here we go. Let's try again. Listener in Champaign, go ahead.
Okay, I'll just repeat in case he didn't hear me. If I remember correctly, one of the reasons the police maintained they had the killer was that the murder stopped after this gentleman's arrest. That's one question. The other one, and this is far afield, but there is a book called The Ultimate Evil by Mallory Terry on the Son of Sam case, and supposedly he got involved in the whole thing. I was curious if he knew anything about that, and I'll hang up and listen. Oh, actually, I do have a comment. It does very much sound like, from what the author is saying, that the police actually knew who the murderer was, and they covered it up and scapegoated this guy. That's my impression, but thank you.
Okay.
Well, to answer your first question, in fact, it's true the murder stopped, but Carlton Gary continued to live in Columbus, Georgia for a year after the murder stopped. Now, he was a criminal. Let us not beat around the bush here. You know, he was not a poster boy. He had a criminal record for robbery, and he was eventually arrested for trying to rob a fast food restaurant rather ineptly. He came in with an unloaded gun. The cashier said, "I don't believe that's loaded, honey," and he ran out back into a swamp, and he was arrested up to his neck in water fairly easily. But that was not until a year after that final killing. I don't know this book, and the Son of Sam case, I've read a little bit about it, mm-hmm. and I saw that movie by Spike Lee some years ago, but I can't really make a comment on that. As to the police knowing who was the real killer, I don't think they did at all. They did, in fact, arrest somebody before Carlton Gary after just the first two killings, They arrested an African-American kind of odd job man called Jerome Livers, who was essentially mentally retarded. He couldn't read. He was of low intelligence. And he confessed to the first two killings. So they had a big press conference, and the mayor was there, and they were all on TV, and everyone said how great they caught this terrible guy. And then two more women got murdered. Well, rather stupidly, the cops and the DA and the mayor maintained, no, we have the right guy. He has confessed. He has told us details that only the killer could have known, precisely the same phrase they would later use in the trial of Carlton Gary. And then, unfortunately for them, a man called Carl Cannon, who was then a young reporter working for the local paper, he's now the White House correspondent for the National Journal, and I believe he's got a book coming out very soon himself about President Bush. He got himself into the county jail, and he interviewed Jerome Livers. And Jerome Livers told him, "Yep, it's true, I killed those first two women, and I also killed John F. Kennedy, and I killed President McKinley, and I kidnapped Charles Lindbergh's baby, and hey, that murder in California in 1935, the Black Dahlia murder, I did that as well." So it did rather seem that what Jerome Livers was a serial confessor rather than a serial killer, and of course they had to let him go. It was hugely embarrassing for the Columbus Police Department that they could not produce a viable suspect. It was worse than embarrassing. I mean, you can only imagine. This is a relatively small city. It's less than 200,000 people. It's a city imbued with the values of the Deep South, where, you know, the white majority has ruled the roost in all kinds of often oppressive ways for a very long time, and suddenly here is this serial killer preying on the most vulnerable members of society with apparent impunity. And in fact, a lot of officials lost their jobs. The mayor was defeated when he ran again for office, purely on the issue of the failure to apprehend the Stocking Strangler. The chief of police, the chief detective, many other officials either left the city and found work elsewhere, or if they were running for office, they lost. And then 6.5 years after the final murder, Carlton Gary was nailed. I think what happened was that a couple of young, ambitious cops, one of whom, by the way, is now the chief of police in Columbus, Georgia, decided they were going to make their names by nailing someone for these murders. And by and large, they succeeded.
Mm. There's a man by the name of Arthur Hardaway, who was a police officer in Columbus, Georgia. He is an African-American. He began on the force in 1967 and left in 1992, and he worked this case. What did he tell you?
Well, he wanted to work this case. He was one of the most experienced homicide detectives. What he was actually told was that he couldn't work this case because these were respected white victims who came from families that had a high position in the city, and he was essentially excluded from it. I think he was asked to do a few very menial kind of house-to-house inquiries. But, I mean, he was a highly intelligent, highly trained detective, and with many medals and decorations, he was kept out of the main action in this case purely because he was black.
Mm. How did African-Americans participate in the life of the city in the late 1970s?
Well, I guess it was a time, maybe it's always a time of transition in the South, but it was to some degree a time of transition. Columbus had a very dark history of racism, of injustice, of lynching, of murder. And one of the things I've tried to do in this book is connect the dots between that violent past and the present. And maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that a bit later. But in the 70s, what was happening was, I think the white majority was waking up to the fact that they had to do something. Other places in the South had already changed quite a bit. They'd changed more quickly than Columbus. One of the reasons, by the way, that Columbus had not changed was that in 1956, the main black civil rights leader, in fact a very significant figure in the early civil rights movement nationally, Dr. Thomas H. Brewer, had been gunned down in cold blood in a department store in front of many witnesses, and his killer had been allowed to walk free because the grand jury, with the help of the district attorney, had decided that the man who killed him acted in self-defense, and that was completely spurious. But the result was that, you know, the city hadn't moved nearly as fast. In the early 70s, there was a tremendous explosion. In 1971, six black police officers who had suffered appalling racial discrimination in the police department. They were part of a group of about 50 black cops in the Columbus Police, which altogether, I think they had about 370 officers on the force. I mean, they weren't even allowed to drink from the same faucets. They weren't allowed to use the drinking fountains. They had to use the water that was used for washing cars in the basement. That's the level of kind of discrimination they faced. They finally, having got nowhere in attempts to protest within the organization, they stood in front of what's called the Consolidated Government Center, which is this big white tower in the middle of Columbus where most of the courts and many administrative buildings are housed, administrative offices are housed. And they cut the U.S. flag from the shoulder lapels of their uniforms because they said that their rights as U.S. citizens had been so badly violated in the Columbus Police Department. Well, they were fired on the spot. And the following weekend, there was a protest march. There was a fairly small one the first weekend. The second weekend, there was a big march led by national civil rights leaders. And it turned into something close to a bloodbath. Several thousand people turned out. The white cops, majority white cops, reacted to this protest by just going wild, and they were breaking people's legs and arms with nightsticks. They were clubbing people with the butts of their guns. There were lots of people very badly injured. This was the trigger for a season of mayhem in Columbus. Fires, night riots, looting, and for about 3 months, Columbus was close to uncontrollable. It's extraordinary that, you know, this is really relatively recent. We're talking about less than 40 years ago, and it's almost completely airbrushed from the collective memory, from the recorded histories of Columbus. There are one or two kind of jolly books about, you know, our town Columbus that have been published in the last few years. None of them mention this episode. Millions of dollars of property was burnt to the ground. It was a very, very ugly time. And so the stocking strangling started to happen just a short while after this. I mean, 6 years after this time when really I think people had thought, you know, things are not good here. I mean, Columbus had the sort of riots that happened elsewhere in America in 1968. They had them in 1971. And the legacy was still very much alive in 1977.
Well, now we've got to talk about the Big Eddie Club. I want to talk about that and what led you there. And then before we close, also, I want to talk with you about capital punishment today in the United States. So what is the Big Eddie Club and what led you there?
Well, the Big Eddie Club is a very nice, upscale dining club. It stands on a beautiful promontory in a very peaceful part of town in the confluence between the Chattahoochee River, the big river that flows down from Atlanta through Columbus and then on down to the Gulf Coast, which is the border with Alabama. The confluence between the Chattahoochee and a tributary called Standing Boy Creek, and the eddy that was formed before, in fact, they dammed the river some years later. Between these two watercourses, in that eddy, it was said that you could get the best catfish. And although if you try to catch and eat catfish from the Chattahoochee now, you would die of some horrible toxic chemical poisoning from the factories in Atlanta, in the 1900s, early 1900s, 1917, 1918, when this club was founded, it was a big deal to have catfish picnics and fries with Chattahoochee catfish. And gradually what happened was the elite industrialists and finance people in the city, it was a very rich city, Columbus, always has been, they founded this club above the eddy where they used to catch their fish, and eventually it had a proper solid stone building, and it became this elite dining club. Now, the thing is that five of the victims of the Stocking Strangler, who were, as I've said, you know, pretty prominent white women, elderly white women, five of them were either victims, sorry, were either members of this club or very frequent visitors. And the white officials who prosecuted Carlton Gary, the judge who tried him, the district attorney, the chief of police, the federal judge who heard his federal habeas corpus appeal, many of these leading white officials involved in his case were also members of this club. Rather interestingly, it remained all white until last year, when the members of the Big Eddie Club discovered that I was about to publish a book called The Big Eddie Club, which was about the history of racism in Columbus, Georgia, and how that had influenced the trial of an African-American who had been convicted and sentenced to death for some of the city's most heinous crimes. And what did they do? They admitted their first African-American member.
Just one?
So far, it could be that in a city where African-Americans have historically, yeah, than other parts of America, not done so well economically. Black families slightly balk at the fact that to be a member of this club, you have to pay about a $10,000 joining fee plus about $7,500 a year. And what you actually get for that is food that isn't particularly great. You just get to be a member of this very elite institution. But, yeah, so far I understand there is one black member.
Mm. But that's
out of about 475, yeah. I should say.
Yeah, but you do get access?
Well, I mean, yeah, black people can get there as guests. In fact...
I was thinking of, you know, access to the powers that be. I mean...
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but,
absolutely.
So if you've got that money in your pocket and you want to be a player in Columbus, it might be a good investment.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, all the swanky charity functions, the swankiest weddings, celebrations of things like Confederate Memorial Day and Old South balls and the kinds of things that go on socially in the Deep South. Yeah, the Big Eddie Club is the place to be. And if you want to meet the elite, and they call themselves the elite, no sense of irony here. They are self-avowedly the elite of Columbus. If you want to meet the people who run the businesses, the people who run the legal system, the people who run the city's administration, that's where you go. And, yeah, there are advantages.
Hmm. When you were visiting Columbus back in March of 2000, you met a couple and a woman who was a lifelong resident of Columbus, Vicki Williams. She and her husband, George, are middle-class African-Americans. And she was unaware of the Big Eddie Club.
That's right. Yeah. I had gone there for lunch that day. A very charming man, and he swore me to secrecy. He said, "You mustn't reveal who took you here, because if you put this in your book, we'll lose all our friends, so I'd better not say who he is." He and his wife had taken me there for lunch, and then later on that day, I sat on the veranda of these people I got to know, African-American couple who become my friends, George and Vicky. George has very sadly passed away last year, by the way. But they both lived in the city all their lives. Vicky had both an undergraduate and a master's degree. She had a very good job in the CB&T Bank, which is the huge bank based in Columbus. And I asked them, what do you think about the Big Eddie Club? I mean, just what you said about access. Is this the place to go where deals are done? Is this how you get ahead in this town? And she looked at me with absolute blankness. And she said, "Well, what's the Big Eddie Club?" And I did think that was very symbolic of the kind of rift that runs through the city.
Hmm. What's your sense of the city today?
Well, I end the book on quite an optimistic note. I mean, there's no doubt it's changed. I've been visiting Columbus since 1996, and I have seen big changes. I mean, it has come further into the 21st century. When I first went there, first of all, the downtown area was totally wasted and destroyed, and at night it was horrible. And now they've built a fantastic performing arts center. They've moved in part of the university there. There's a very good university in Columbus. And there are bookstores and there are cafes and there's nightlife. And it's kind of lively and it's interracial. You see interracial groups of friends, mainly younger people, either from the military at Fort Benning or students from the university. And you even see interracially dating couples. And all that's very positive. And so I did feel quite upbeat when I ended the book. But I have to say, the reaction to the book in Columbus has made me realize that it has changed less than perhaps I'd hoped. I went to Columbus a few months ago. I gave a couple of big public events there. In fact, they were extremely well attended. And the book, I may say, has become an enormous seller in Columbus. The book is not a bestseller anywhere in the world except in Columbus, Georgia, where quite a high proportion of the households there seem to have bought copies. And I was very well treated. People were very polite. But I got out of town, and then the reaction started. And people literally started holding meetings to denounce me and the book, not because I had reported anything that was in any way inaccurate. Nobody came to me and said, "You wrote this," but none of the white officials who I accuse of lying, of deceiving a jury, of breaching their legal and constitutional jury as officers of the court, none of them have made a single word of complaint. But the tenor is, you have trashed the reputation of good men. You have said that good good public servants in this city have done wrong, and you have done it just to try to make money. I wish I had made money from this book. I can tell you that it cost me a great deal more to research than I'd ever get to make in royalties. Mm-hmm. But it's just like, you dare criticize us. I had wounded Southern honor. And there's one guy called Mark Shelnut. He's an attorney himself. He's a former assistant district attorney who had worked with some of the officials I criticized most harshly in the book. And he has been unstoppable. I mean, he seems to be calling these meetings every few weeks, trying to sort of... If I go back there and I'm determined that I shall, I'm sure he's going to try to have me run out of town.
Hmm. Well, before we run out of time, we have to talk about capital punishment. You mentioned earlier in the interview that now in the United States, close to 200 inmates have been released from death row in light of new evidence or evidence of their trials being found seriously flawed. Do you see a shift in opinion about the death penalty in the United States?
Well, I mean, the polling evidence certainly suggests that there is a shift. 10, 15 years ago, polls suggested that over 80% of people in America supported capital punishment. Nowadays, especially if you present life without parole as an alternative, it's still well above 50%. It's around 60%. But, you know, the majority in favor of the death penalty has declined. And equally, it's clear that many people have reservations. In Illinois, of course, Governor Ryan commuted the sentences of everyone on death row after the remarkable work done that proved that, I forget if it was 12 or 13 people on death row were entirely innocent. All that has unquestionably had an impact. And if you look at the numbers of executions, they have been declining, not very dramatically, but nonetheless significantly since 2000. The sort of high watermark of the number of executions per year in America was about 100 in 1999-2000. It's now down, well, at the moment it's slightly special circumstances because the Supreme Court has essentially put a hold on executions while it decides whether lethal injection is cruel and unusual. But even without that, you're now talking in the kind of 40 to 50 range of executions per year. And they're also becoming more geographically concentrated. I mean, it's going to take an awful lot to persuade Texas to give up the death penalty. Texas has accounted for more executions by far since the death penalty came back in 1976 when the Supreme Court ended its moratorium than any other state. And right now, and for a number of years now, more executions take place in Texas than anywhere else. So I could foresee a time when the death penalty starts to kind of wither away in America, where in a number of states that have carried out executions, it just stops being used. But then there are countervailing currents that, you know, don't go with that. You know, Ohio didn't execute anybody until 1999, and I think they're now up to about 35th execution since 1999. Missouri hardly, and I think Missouri's first execution was in the mid-90s. They're now up in the 40s. So it's unpredictable, and I think opinion is less solidly behind it than it was, but there's a long way to go for death penalty abolitionists.
Yeah. I have one last question, and then we've got to wrap up here because I'm out of time, but I can give you a minute. Capital punishment was abolished in Britain in the 1960s. Can you tell us very briefly what led to its end?
Well, there was a tremendous campaign. People were unhappy for the same sorts of reasons that they are in America, that they felt it was often unjust, that people were potentially innocent, and that people who did not deserve to die were being hanged. And one of the landmark cases was a woman called Ruth Ellis who shot her lover and who was unfaithful to her. And, you know, it was a crime of passion. It was widely felt she didn't deserve to die. I think what's interesting is that when capital punishment was abolished, it was a very emotive issue. You were for or against it passionately. More than 40 years later, it's a totally, if I may say so, dead issue. Nobody gets worked up about the death penalty in Britain now. It's just accepted. We don't have the death penalty. If you are a victim of a heinous crime, you may hope that the person convicted of killing your loved one will get life without parole. You will be satisfied. You will get, to use that phrase that death penalty supporters sometimes use, closure from that event. There is no widespread support for the restoration of the death penalty in Britain. And I think, you know, as things stand, it's inconceivable that it could come back, even, say, for terrorists.
Hmm. David Rose, thank you for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
Journalist David Rose has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He's also worked for The Guardian, The Observer, and the BBC. His latest book is The Big Eddie Club, The Stocking Stranglings, and Southern Justice. The publisher, The New Press.